speaking to us from her home in New Delhi, India. On Thursday, we'll spend the hour with Noam Chomsky, and on Friday, we'll look back at 25 years of Democracy Now! To see our interview with Ed Snowden, go to democracynow.org. Be safe in this new year. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you.
KBOO's end of your drive is almost over. We invite you to become a member right now by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Contribute during this last week of 2021 and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $8,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Hurry and join the KBOO family today and help us meet our $45,000 goal at kboo.fm/give. Together we can do it, and thanks for your support.
Sex, race, and class, it's all there in Toni Morrison's latest novel, Love. It is brilliant, moving, simple, yet complex storytelling that is riveting as it is beautiful. It is a view into a slice of the Black community during the pre- and post-civil rights period that also reflects society as a whole. It is an intersection of art and politics so hard to achieve successfully, yet I think achieved in love. The range, depth, and clarity of the characters and the insight into how the influences on human behavior and how the divisions among us are played out in day-to-day living are beautifully reflected in love. We're delighted to welcome to Morning Review, the Sojourner Truth edition, Black woman writer, Nobel Prize laureate, and Pulitzer Prize winner, Toni Morrison. Ms. Morrison, you have a huge fan base in our audience. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, this is a pleasure for me.
Oh, very good. I must ask you at the start, it has been reported that you have said many Black writers write for a white audience. Would you care to comment on that? And, you know, do you include yourself in that? Did you even say that?
Yeah, I said it. But what I meant was, it doesn't matter who reads the book. You write for the widest audience you can garner. What I meant was, in the reading of a number of particularly early on books by Black writers, I, as a reader, could sense that they were addressing their remarks to a non-Black audience because that was, I suppose, the confrontation. A simple example, the book I love a lot and admire the author a lot, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. Well, the title gives it away, this awareness of the gaze of a white reader, because that character is not invisible to me, to a Black person.
Yes.
He's invisible in the outside world. So it's the outside world that the narrator is addressing or editorializing for or explaining for, just, you know, in an absolutely flawless way. But when you read other Black writers, sometimes you get the feeling, or I do, that they are explaining things that I know. I mean, every Black person would not need to be told
right.
These things. So let's, you know, that was just a difference, I think, a shift in perhaps contemporary African-American writing from earlier writing, that's all.
Yes, so you think that has changed today?
I think so.
Yes.
I think the voice is so obviously directed within the community, and some people thought that meant that if you're writing as specifically as you can and carefully as you can within the community, that that is an exclusionary tactic, when it's just the opposite. It's when you know your material and it pleases yourself as a reader and readers like you, then other people from other cultures have access to it because of its specificity.
Yes, absolutely. Now, you have referred to race as the heart of democracy, and you have described race as the canvas of your new book, Love. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, there are very little, few things that you could talk about in this country that does not have race and racism as its underground. Sometimes underground, sometimes on the ground. Subject, if you talk about the public school system, that's what you're talking about. If you talk about health care, that's what you're talking about. If you talk about the prison system, that's really what you're talking about. If you talk about labor law, that's what you're talking about.
Right.
I mean, there's virtually nothing that you can say, because the history of apartheid and separation and denigration is so deeply ingrained in not just the body politic, but the minds of blacks and whites, that it's very difficult. You can't extricate it. And, you know, everything. I mean, the last election, or the question of voting rights, or the question of full citizenship, or the question of representation. I mean, all of those things can only be addressed completely and honestly when you are addressing racial problems. What's affirmative action about? It certainly isn't about women being offered places in the university because they are women and have been repressed, and therefore need a wider open door. I don't hear any women complaining about affirmative action.
Uh-huh.
It's only blacks who bear the brunt of that argument. They are the ones who may be getting something for nothing, or being given special treatment, which is understood to be, quote, unfair, unquote.
Yes. Now, it's interesting that you said that, because I wanted to ask you about women, because you do deal with women a lot. You have said that you like outlaw women, and certainly your new novel, Love, is full of them, but also your other books, from The Bluest Eye to Sula, Beloved, and more. And in Love, you have a range of outlaw women, including a mysterious lead character who happens to be but one of the prostitute women in the story. What is it about outlaw women? Tell us about that.
Well, I guess it's a fascination for someone outside the border, so to speak, a daring woman. They generally come to a bad and weeping end in traditional literature.
That's true.
Because if they do something anarchic, they are beaten back, or they die, or what have you. And sometimes what they do is terrible and has consequences, you know, that might justify their pain. Nevertheless, as a writer, it's that person who pushes the envelope, who says no, who says, I'm not doing it that way. And whether they win or lose, you know, Beloved was a woman who said, no, I am not letting my children go back to slavery. Or it may be some other form of, you know, battle. But they, for me, it just opens the door to other kinds of consideration. And, you know, my life is very humdrum, so maybe that's another reason why I'm very interested in these women who just, you know, say no and stand up and take it on and run with it.
Yeah, I mean, you say you deal with race, but it seems to me as though you also address the issue of sex and sexism quite well. I was quite struck in reading Love, Your New Novel, with your understanding of how the work of women, often invisible background type work, even the work you may describe as humdrum, but that it keeps things going and that it often makes men look good.
Right.
Yeah, and one character described the work of herself and a woman who later lost her mind as, quote, the two of us were like the back of a clock. What a wonderful way to describe essential work.
Yeah, he was the face. Well, those things are intertwined for me, race and gender, because you have the two, you know, categories of people who had to fight and struggle for even the smallest things, let alone, you know, opportunities to fulfill themselves completely. And it's in Love I really wanted to expose, describe, and explore the gamut of the various kinds of love, and especially, of course, various kinds of the ways in which women love each other and how they, what you said before about how they relate to Bill Cozy, the man who sort of is the center of their lives or the void of their lives, is because in many instances, women give men that power and ascribe him all those roles of friend, father, lover, benefactor, what have you. And the men take it, I suppose, or don't take it, or refuse it. But what was true, I think, about those women, at least I hope it was clear, is that it was only until they could sort of exorcise him, you know, the last chapter called
yes.
Phantom,
yes.
But they sort of find out who they were. It's true that he manipulated their lives and ruined some of them. But they were complicit in it, in a way. All they wanted to do was, who did he love most? Who did he ruin fast? What, you know, that constant cycle of we were his victims, and they're fighting over his legacy. Nobody just said, oh, well, forget about it.
Yes, and to really give the broadest view of love, it addresses a number of things. I mean, you do talk about love and the way women love each other and all of what you described. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Southern California, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. You're listening to the Sojourner Truth edition of Morning Review, and we're having a discussion with Black woman author and Pulitzer Prize winner, Toni Morrison. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. We'll be right back.
Please join Dr. Earl Ofari Hutchinson, host of Tuesday Live, tonight at 7 p.m. The Morning Review with Margaret Prescott returns in a moment, followed by Uprising with Sonali Kolhatkar beginning at 8 a.m. Don't go away.
Through the years, you've been listening to history. Now, listen to her story. Feminist Magazine. Hi, I'm Desiree Vanderwaal with Feminist Magazine. Listen Wednesday night from 7 until 8 o'clock on KPFK 90.7 FM, Pacifico Radio.
You're listening to the Sojourner Truth edition of Morning Review, and we're having a discussion with Toni Morrison about her new book, Love. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Now, your story is based around a Black-owned resort that some have equated with a Black-owned resort in American Beach, Florida. And the case has been made that the civil rights movement that opened the door for integration was in part responsible for the demise of a sector of black-owned businesses in the black community when segregation existed. Do you think there has been a demise, or has there been a shift of that sector? And what do you think that has meant for those who have been left behind, so to speak, in the inner city areas, or the parts that are primarily still primarily black and other people of color?
Well, there are a number of consequences of the civil rights movement. I just didn't want it to appear so simple that everybody just jumped on the wagon and said, let's go.
Yeah.
Because there were people who were frightened of it and alarmed by it, and they were people who had gone to those really first-rate black schools, and they had gone to Howard University's Law School or School of Architecture or to Meharry Medical School, or were entrepreneurs, and they serviced a fairly captive audience, which were other black people. And they were people that people were proud of, you know, the race men, they were called, or race women. But the interesting thing is that they sort of had to live together, you know, on the same street. The doctor lived next door to the, I don't know, sanitation worker who lived next door to the barber. So that the class division was not so overwhelming. You could see them. Then here comes the civil rights movement, which was absolutely necessary and absolutely important. But it had some losses. People could then go vacation someplace else, or go to some other school, or move into other neighborhoods. And all I am suggesting is that that kind of leap forward progress, however difficult it was, has a loss. You pay a price for it. Every group that came to this country did. We just did it belatedly. You know, there are people who have told me that when the schools were integrated in their part of, say, a small town in the South, what happened was that the best black teachers left and went to the white school.
Yes.
And then we had years, you know, decades of black schools begging for money. They have revitalized themselves since then. But there was a drain from schools that had these first-rate reputations because other schools were vying for that population, or students could choose whether to go, you know, to one place or another. So I just wanted to complicate that story a little bit, because I think some of it is still flopping around. Those questions, that debate, in the contemporary world.
Yes, and in fact, I did want to ask you about that. I mean, it's wonderful, in fact, that you addressed it. I mean, in Love, several, if not all, the sectors, frankly, on the economic scale of society are represented. From those who live in dire poverty, from a place you call in the book the settlement, to factory workers, to maids, to cooks, to prostitutes, to owners. And the clash and the interrelationship of those sectors. I mean, you show tremendous insight into the point of view of all of these sectors, and you also show some sympathy for them. I wanted to just raise with you to just compare that to what is happening in the black world today, in the black community today. Do you see a change? Do you see, I think from your previous answer, you're saying the sectors in some cases are further apart than they had been, and that this has been part of the impact of what is now a greatly expanded black middle class.
Yeah, which moved out.
Yeah.
Moved someplace else. And left those neighborhoods for the people, you know, who had the fewest and the least resources. The lawyers may still practice in those communities. They don't live there. But the problem for me was either or. If you chose integration and assimilation, why did that necessarily mean that you couldn't have the resources in black communities at the same time?
That yes.
Is, did you have to integrate, or could you just bring the money into the schools where they were? Did you have to, you know, it was never an either or situation. For me, it looked like there was one road only, and which we took, which was taken, and that had some, you know, peril involved in it. And we can still see the, you can still see it, you know, in neighborhoods. The authenticity of the race culturally comes from the street, but the execution of the cultural forces in the academy, etc., is assimilated. You have to transfer those cultural icons and mores and folklore into something else, so that you have people who study black people, I mean blacks who study other blacks,
yes,
in order to say this is what it is, which is, I'm not denigrating any of this, I'm just talking about the shift. But I think now there's also a call or an awareness of that part of the cultural life of the black community that one lost, that we lost, even in the more radical days of the civil rights movement. There were people who were black nationalists who were screaming for exactly what Bill Cozy had: black businesses, black patronizing each other, living separately from white people, I mean choosing to live separately from white people, having your own stuff. But at, during the height of the movement, there was the other side of it, which was also, you know, assimilation. It's a very complex thing, and I think it is the main theme of the acquisition of full democratic rights in this country. It can always be viewed through the glass, the magnifying glass, when you look at what happened to black people.
Yes, it's interesting that you have said that. A few weeks ago, I spoke with the Caribbean author George Lamming, who wrote that wonderful book, In the Castle of My Skin.
Right.
Yes, and one of the things he talked about in referring to the growing middle class in the Caribbean region, he was frankly a bit critical, and he said, listen, there's a kind of a moral bankruptcy going on, and that this is contributing to some of the problems that we're having with our youth now. And we know that there is a tension between and within the black community. I know we don't like to talk about it that much, but it does exist between that middle class and between those with the least, with the grassroots. And you actually addressed this tension in Love in the wonderful storytelling way that you have. So from what you're saying, you do think that it is a significant thing to address in the black community. And I wondered if you observed this kind of shift going on as you were growing up and developing in Lorraine, Ohio, or something that
so many thousands of years ago. It hadn't happened then.
Right.
Until, of course, everybody that I knew in Lorraine was dirt poor, but I think it was one doctor. He lived sort of around the corner. We didn't socialize with them, but I think there were other reasons for that. But I do remember it being very distinctive in when I was in college. You know, when I went away to school, which was, you know, in the 50s, and then began to see it rapidly in the late 50s, or at least the situation in which you could talk about people who were in my socioeconomic class as a kid as them. I mean, I was a them.
Right.
But, you know, money does that. And this country is, you know, class ridden. It doesn't like to talk about it because they've always been able to say black people instead of poor people. But in fact, that is a very big matter here. And the only way you can show that you have arrived is not necessarily by education, but for other people, it's just the acquisition of things. You know, you just buy stuff. And that gives you, you know, sort of feeling that, you know, you crossed the line somewhere.
Yes, and that brings us, that buying stuff brings us to, there's a character in Love named Dark Cosey, who in fact was the father, I think, of Bill Cosey, who was the main character. And this Dark Cosey, and interesting that you chose that name, he was adept at accumulating wealth. In fact, he made money during the Great Depression, and it was actually described as part of a long line of black folks going back to slavery that was into that kind of accumulation. And Dark is not a sympathetic character.
No, he's a traitor. He's a stooge.
Yeah.
Stooge. He, that story they told about how wonderful they were was all fantasy with Bill Cosey's family. The truth was that his father did have a lot of money, earned it, but he earned it in, you know, a nefarious way. There used to be, and they probably are now, not quite informants, but people who white establishment figures can count on to tell them what's going on, who was hiding in the neighborhood,
right,
who had done, you know, and he was paid for that service. And that's a real, that's informing, not because you have to or somebody's threatening you or because, you know, there's something in exchange, but that's money. And that money was so bloody and so soiled. So his son, who inherits it, decides to do just the opposite and have this fabulous resort and classy entertainers and women and men who came were, you know, the creme de la creme, and let everybody have fun. That was his plan. Well, of course, you know, things do go awry.
Things do go awry. And you also, though, even with Bill Cosey, in the book, you do show that there was a time that he actually refused a request on the part of some members of the black community to, I think, sell some land or something and made another kind of deal. So even though he tried to do the opposite of his father, it seemed as though there was still a little of the chip off the old block left.
Jump on that right away, although I think his wife, by the time he was old then and probably didn't care, I think he'd had a lot to do with that. But there is a character in the book whom I liked. Her name is Vida, married to Sandler.
Yes.
And they represented for me a kind of norm, a nice couple, warm but stern and very much aware of their grandson. And she says at one point something that was sort of interesting, which is, she disagrees with her husband about this. She says if he had given that land, they would have had some karate places and some art places and some, you know, health food stores.
Right.
But they wouldn't have had any houses, which is what happened to that property. It was developed by somebody, put money into living quarters and took them out of the swamps. So there were even two sides to that. You know, the money they wanted an African-American center, they wanted Head Start, all those good things.
Yeah.
And she's not so sure that if you have to choose which one.
Yes, and I'm glad you mentioned Sandler Gibbons. I was really quite delighted with his character. But one of the things he said in relation to Bill Cosey, who after listening to Cosey talk about the problems that he had, he could, quote, swallow hot rocks easier than he could the complaints of a rich man.
Right.
On the one hand, but then on the other hand, in the novel, you know, that does show some sympathy also for Bill Cosey, in particular when he speaks about his son. And also one of the wise women in the book, she says something, I don't remember the quote, a kind of a paraphrase, but something like, rich people could act like sharks, but what motivates them was a kid's sweet tooth. Does that imply, you know, a kind of a redemption for the class in a way that is a microcosm really of the wider society?
In a way, because, you know, when he was strutting his stuff, he was very useful. He could get people out of jail and he helped pay tuition for college. You know, he was very generous in the community. And when they approach him and call him an Uncle Tom or whatever, He knows all those people. And he asks about them, because he's the one who paid for the truck. He's the one who did that. Now, that's the consequences of having money. But also, for himself, you know, it's a kind of, when you get money, what do you do with it? It's narcissistic. You know, he wanted a good time. And he wanted everybody to like him.
Yeah.
You know, which is what you feel when you're 6 years old. You just get bigger and you want more.
A bit infantilized,
right?
There.
But her judgment of him was probably one that was closest now to what I thought, and that's not always the case with these I narrators. When she says he didn't have an S on his T-shirt and he didn't carry a pitchfork, she said he was just torn like the rest of us between wrath and love. So she said he was an ordinary man who had the same things. I just did not want to create a monster, you know, a rich man who was a stereotypical, you know, greedy guy.
Yeah.
And who had some serious flaws. And he could indulge his whims. That's what money does. It lets you make your little silly wishes come true. So he could marry a girl who was obviously not marriageable for all sorts of reasons, punitive reasons, and as well as desire. But at the same time, he had some large instinct for generosity, and he had a fairly good opinion of himself most of the time. But at the same time, the damage that he did was, you know, unquestionable and severe. And the women either felt they had no other recourse or just tried to manipulate the situation so that they, each one would come out on top.
Yes, well, I you gave that character, I mean, you made him real and gave him, you know, the kind of depth that one can really take hold of. But then they are, speaking of his wife, they are the Johnsons from Up Beach. And the description of the inhabitants of this community reminds me so much, actually, of how those who are frequently spoken of, even by some, unfortunately, in the black leadership or in the middle class, and also grassroots people who are determined to make it out in such exasperated tones of people who destroy their community, like here in the L.A. Rebellion, or people who don't like to work,
right.
You know, or
right.
Those children who are incorrigible and will end up in jail. So, tell us about that clash, because he the Knight, and you got to say something about that name, one of the lead female characters and the wife of this Bill Cosey, is from Up Beach.
Oh, yeah.
So here you have this, the wealthiest man in town, marrying a girl, really, from Up Beach.
She didn't even have a dress. She wore a man's T-shirt.
Right.
But I wanted that, you know, because his granddaughter is her friend, and she is hers. Those little girls, they didn't know who was rich, who was not. They just liked one another.
Yeah.
And when he marries her, it's just shocking, of course, because of her age. But I always felt that one of the biggest shocks, for at least for the town and for the people in the hotel, was partly her age, which was exceptionally young, but also she was one of those, she came from that kind of family, that really trifling, totally lazy kind, just totally dysfunctional. They were not just poor. A lot of people were that. But they were just, you know, they're not doing anything. What they did was give all their children these grandiose names.
Yes, and tell us about that. I mean, that is something in and of itself. What? Where did that come from, Heed the Knight?
Well, her name came to me with the character, and I didn't know what that was, but I tend to listen to him if that's what I hear. And the phrase came after I realized that those children were called things like Righteous Mourning, and Solitude, whatever else was going on.
Right.
And then he when she finally sees him as a little girl and he asks her her name, she says it, and it was that phrase, "He the Knight." But who knows where those people got those names from? They were like naming boats or something.
Right.
But I wanted to go as far down the social ladder as I could.
Yeah.
And as far up.
Yes.
I mean, you know, normal. I think they're familiar.
Very familiar.
And among us, you know, there were people, families or fathers who ran families in that way, which is not running them at all. And people who had the same paucity of resources would shake their heads because this was a person with not just without ambition, but was living off of, you know, this little section in there where she tries to go back and see her family, and all they do is say, "Can I have some? Do you need that? Can you lend me a little this?"
Yeah, they're gonna get access to that to that wealth that they've been, and it's interesting because now on the name thing, I mean, nowadays you have, you know, people naming their kids things like Lexus and mm-hmm. you know, that sort of thing, which is a, you know, a whole other story. But interestingly, because the people from Up Beach in a way are reflective of the people who in fact were the ones left behind in that flight, you know, of the middle class and in the inner cities and representing that growing gap. But I wanted to ask you about the male youth. You've got a young black man in the story, the character Roman, who had quite a time being, you know, being decent. You know, he had to pay a price for that. Why do you think this character is important? And I also know you have a couple of sons, don't you? Yeah, and I wondered if that experience really helped in your understanding of a young man kind of growing up and grappling with stuff and, you know, what it means to be a black man in America.
Yeah, partly so, particularly somebody who's 14.
Yeah.
That very vulnerable age when, you know, what you're going to do is be a man, right? That's the whole point. But this kid, whom I really, really liked his company, he had a natural instinct to care for somebody, to
yes.
care for something that was wounded. He didn't even know he had it. And in that scene where he's supposed to join in with the assault, and he rescues that girl, and he is ashamed of himself because that kind of instinct is understood to be weakness. And his fellow 14-year-olds call him names. He has embarrassed them by this, you know, it's a girlish thing to do, they say. And he, of course, is, I suppose, redeemed by this other young girl who comes to town.
Yeah.
And he can, you know, fulfill his appetites.
Right.
But I always knew he was going to be the one who would rescue those women. For almost the same reason, because that kind of love, which is what humans do when they're untampered with, is so natural. It's not natural or inevitable that we just come out of the cradle and just start hating one another. There is this other thing, and only human beings feel that. Only human beings have language that complicated enough to reconcile. And it's not just a question of the preservation of the species. It's a much more complicated thing. So I was showing that kind of love, which is just one human being looking at another and seeing you in trouble and not pushing on and helping you in your, you know, have more trouble. And also those young girls, and also romantic love, also the love between Roman's grandparents, which is the kind of an old-timey companionship where you see couples who don't even have to talk anymore because they know what
yeah.
each one is going to say, plus the speaker, the L character, who has a different kind of, I don't know, it's not quite maternal, but it's wide-spirited. You know, she's very judgmental, but, you know, she's not going to call the cops.
Yes. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's KPFK 90.7 FM in Southern California, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. You're listening to the Sojourner Truth edition of Morning Review, and we're having a discussion with Toni Morrison about her new book, Love. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. We'll be right back.
Atención, atención. Escuchen el nuevo programa Radio Insurgencia Femenina, donde escucharás toda una variedad de temas, música, poesía y mucho más para la mujer.
Sintonízate.
Cada otro martes a las 9:30 de la noche en su estación KPFK 90.7 FM en Los Ángeles y 98.7 FM en Santa Bárbara.
La participación de las mujeres ha sido fundamental en la lucha de los pueblos para una sociedad mejor.
Lucha la mujer campesina.
Lucha la mujer revolucionaria.
Lucha la mujer obrera.
Lucha la mujer estudiante.
Lucha la mujer trabajadora.
Lucha la mujer indígena.
Lucha la mujer profesionista.
Lucha la mujer científica.
Lucha la mujer humilde.
Lucha la mujer artista.
Lucha la mujer proletaria. Y tú lucharás también.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Southern California, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. You're listening to the Sojourner Truth edition of Morning Review, and we're having a discussion with Toni Morrison. One of the main characters in the book is someone who hardly appears at all. I mean, she's always there. But, you know, tell us a little about that. I mean, that was something that's at least new to me and quite different and very effective, I might add.
She opens the book and closes it. She also intervenes in it. And I thought she had a wonderful sound in her voice. I mean, her knowledge and her eccentricities and so on were very appealing to me. But she has another role to play. She was very much involved in that family and understood things they didn't understand. It was a figure I could use to expose certain kinds of secrets and also to comment, you know, generally like an observer. At some point, she is no longer there, but I mean, no longer in the real world, but, you know, for her, it's just one more step. She's still commenting and meddling in people's lives and having something to say and so on. But she was technically a solution and a really interesting one because she really affects a lot in that household, not just by cooking and watching, but she's the one who steps in and stops things. She's the one who clarifies things. And I liked her because she probably only says four things, or has four, maybe five sentences in the whole book to people in the book. And she identifies herself as quiet. She doesn't talk. She doesn't do this. She was always that unspeaking person. But she's talking all the time in the book, constantly. You know, talking to the reader.
Yes.
She's not talking to the character.
Right. Well, it was very effective. I know we are running short of time. There's so much we can talk about. There are two things, though, that I really would like to ask you about. One, just getting back to Heed the Knight for a moment, that character from Up Beach. And, you know, there is that view of people, you know, there are those people over there who are unproductive or whatever, which many of us know is far from the case. You know, it takes so much to survive on very, very little, which people obviously had to do. But this Heed the Knight was also very clever. I mean, here was someone who wasn't really literate, but she is really quite bright. And I think that also says something to people.
They were
from
stupid. They weren't stupid. They were just that family. They could manage to live without doing anything. But he has, you know, when you say somebody's illiterate, generally you think, well, they just, you know, they'll never learn. But if you don't read, you have to use other kinds of sensibilities.
Right.
you have to be serious. It's like I've had students who had those reading problems where they can't put the sentences together and the words go back. They have to do something else. It's like a blind person has to have strong hearing and a deaf person has to see. You know, you overcompensate for certain deficiencies. And she was not only knowledgeable in a number of areas, she was cunning also.
Absolutely. And also, there's a character who lost her mind, one of the women who lost her mind, May. And it was just amazing how you really had an insight into that. It was almost as though her madness, you could actually understand it in a way I found in reading it. It really showed an insight into that state of mind. I was quite struck by that. But finally, I did want to ask you about film. I was quite struck when a comment that a Black Caribbean-based author said to me, it might have been Lamming actually, that the view that people who live outside of the United States have of Black people living in the United States is what they see on film. And for so many reasons that I can't state right now, there isn't time, that is really a scary thought. But one I'm sure is grounded in some reality, and at least one of your books, Beloved, was made into film. I wondered what do you think of that? I mean, would I broach too much to ask if the thought occurred to you about love perhaps being made into a film?
Oh, I'm scared of the whole thing. I don't know anything about it. I mean, about the filmmaking industry, except the fun stuff, you know. But it's a huge medium. And it seems to me, I think I heard an actor say, it's too big to be merely entertainment. But the fact is that that's what it's about. And it just gets more outrageous and more outrageous and more unproductive than ever. And it's a sorry state, I think, not just of African-American films, I'm just hypersensitive to that.
Yeah.
But almost all of them.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's an almost a kind of perversion, you know, to see all these things that we fought so hard on, and they fought so hard long before I got on this earth in order to correct, being displayed as fun without wit, you know, and without subtlety and without nuance, just blatant and overwhelming and chuckling. Nobody went to see Beloved. I mean, very few people went to see Beloved.
Wow. What a
and
loss.
And it had all these incredible reviews and all this work by the Harpo and all those people who did it. And what everyone thinks about whether one likes the movie or not, the fact is that it was serious.
Yes.
It was a serious film.
Yes, a serious film based on a very, very serious book.
And nobody wanted to, nobody wanted to see it. Although I have to say that any film about slavery from the point of view of a slave fails at the box office unless it's Birth of a Nation or Gone with the Wind.
Well, that's quite a comment
They are not from the point of view of the slave.
That's right. That's quite a comment on where we are right now. Would you care to comment on your next project? I know you always have a next project. Is that right?
I try to always have one. I don't feel good when I don't. but what I have in mind now is just so vague and fragile. I couldn't even begin to explain it because I haven't explained it to myself yet.
I do understand that. Well, I wondered just if before leaving us, there was anything you wanted to say just about the situation we find ourselves in today as a community and as a nation. I mean, here we are very much living in a globalized world. The comment on film reflected that, the idea that people in the Caribbean region or that huge population of black people who are in Brazil, that their view of those of us living in the United States is, I mean, it's heartbreaking, really. And I wondered, given the wars that are happening, the situation in Iraq, I mean, it just anything now that you would wish you had the time to say and didn't have to say, and you had to 2 minutes to say it,
okay.
What would you share with us?
I have two things to say. One, the world is vile. Two, it's going to be all right.
Well, Toni Morrison, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was really a pleasure.
Yeah, many in our audience are huge fans of yours, and there's so much more we would like to hear from you, and we certainly
I'm going to come out there.
Oh, wonderful. That's very good news. Well, thank you again for being gracious enough to speak with us.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. follow KBRU on all your social media platforms. Just look for KBRU on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Get access to our new content and news, as well as special offers and contests. Like and share your favorite community radio station, KBRU.
KBRU Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right. 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make a donation to help keep KBRU independent and non-commercial at kboo.fm/give. But right now, during our end-of-year drive, it's the perfect time to contribute. Give now and help us reach our goal of $45,000 by December 31st, and your donation will be matched, dollar for dollar, up to $10,000, thanks to the generous support of the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund for the Oregon Community